We have come in our study of God's Word to the Ten Commandments in Exodus 20. And we've been talking about the commandments as guides for Christian living, as principles to guide God's people in their conduct, not as a way of salvation. Salvation is by grace. It has always been by God's free grace. But these are more specifically the terms of the covenant, and they're called just that. They're commandments, yes, but this is what God's people are to do. Now, we come today to the fourth commandment. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days shalt thou labor and do all thy work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord thy God. In it thou shalt not do any work, thou, nor thy son, nor thy daughter, thy manservant, nor thy maidservant, nor thy cattle, nor thy stranger that is within thy gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth, the sea, and all that in them is, and rested the seventh day. Wherefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and hallowed it. Now the word Sabbath means rest, not seventh as such. In the New Testament, the first day is normally pointed to as the day of rest, instead of the seventh. Now, I know wonderful Christians that still worship on the seventh day, keeping this Old Testament pattern. But in the New Testament, Paul says on the first day of the week, let every one of you lay by him in store as God hath prospered him. Worship God with a portion of that with which God has blessed you. In Acts 20, we're told that on the first day of the week, the disciples came together to break bread, to have the Lord's Supper. In Revelation 1, John was in the Spirit on the Lord's day. Now, this is so clear in the early Christian fathers. We do not treat the early fathers now as part of the Bible. Oh, no, never. But these were the folks that knew the apostles personally. And I'm not going to tarry with this, but let me read you just a sentence or two. This is Justin Martyr. He lived until the year 155 when he was put to death in Rome, because he was a Christian, and he wrote this earlier, and he says, on the day called Sunday, there's a meeting in the place of those who live in cities or in the country, and the memoirs of the apostles or the writings of the prophets are read as long as time permits. And then he says there's a sermon, and there are prayers, and after that the bread is brought and the wine, and we have the Lord's Supper. And then with the prayers, the prayers concluded by the whole congregation saying amen. Some of you will go to church where people say amen. Well, they did that in the early church. Here it is, clear as a bell. And then you'd find the same thing in one of John's disciples, in the letters of Ignatius. This is real early. You don't know the exact date of its writing, maybe in the 90s. And he says that the Christians ceased to keep the Sabbath and lived by the Lord's day. And then he goes on at great length to say that on the Lord's day they gathered for worship and things like that, and that the keeping of Sunday as the Sabbath is based mostly on the resurrection of the Christ on that day. Now, this commandment tells us that people need to rest. lack of rest leads to stress. Just like the lack of work leads to a lack of meaning in life. And now, this was given to Israel at Mount Sinai. And it also, we're told in Deuteronomy, commemorates the deliverance from Egypt and things like this. And again, the main point of Sunday is that on it we celebrate the resurrection. One of the reformers, John Calvin, didn't like the idea of celebrating Easter. Oh, he believed in the resurrection now, but he says if we have one Sunday set apart to celebrate the resurrection, we'll forget that that's the point of every Sunday. And I think he had a point. Jesus says the Son of Man is the Lord of the Sabbath. It's his day. And so to keep the Sabbath is to accept the rest that Christ has provided. Now, this commandment tells us, first of all, that we ought to work 6 days. And here's going to be part of the Christian attitude toward work. So often when folks talk about this commandment, they just skip this part that says, 6 days shalt thou labor. This commands work, for those who are able to work, of course. You see, Paul's going to say in 2 Thessalonians, if you've got some fellow that will not work, neither let him eat. He's not talking about sick folks or something like that. And he says in 1 Thessalonians that we ought to work with our own hands. We are to keep this day holy, the Lord's day, as a day set apart, dedicated. And we should make due preparation of our minds, our bodies, our clothes. And somebody's going to say, oh, it doesn't matter what you wear. Yes, it does. And emphasis on this is in the Old Testament in particular, that the way you dress for an occasion shows to everybody how important you think it is. And so we should prepare our bodies, our minds. We should rest from worldly employments and recreations. And we should spend this day in public and private worship as well as in rest. You see, there are some things, of course, that have to be done. The expression is works of necessity and mercy. The farmer better milk the cows on Sunday, or else he's in for real trouble in his dairy. The doctor has some work that he has to do on Sunday. There are other things that must be done. Now, I'm not going to make a list of things you do and don't do. The Pharisee did that nearly a couple of thousand years ago. He had it all worked out, how many steps you could walk on the Sabbath day, what you could pick up and couldn't. And Jesus understood that they had missed the point. Here's the command, then, that God's people are to work, to labor. God made us so that we need to work. And then, on one day of the week, we need to rest and to worship. And we'll teach little children so much by the preparations we make for going to church and Sunday school, by what we do on Sunday. This will mold their thinking about the importance of God, the importance of things spiritual and eternal, and things like that. Now, the next commandment says, honor thy father and thy mother, that thy days may be long in the land which the Lord thy God giveth thee. Here's the principle of respect for authority and obedience in all areas of life. Paul begins with this commandment, and then he talks about obedience of servants and the duties of fathers and masters. Modern man doesn't like the idea of obedience to any authority. He sees it as being in conflict with his freedom and his independence and things like this. But the story of sin and evil and pain and grief is simply the story of man's rebellion against authority from the Garden of Eden until existentialism, the new philosophy of individualism since World War II. At least it's been made popular since World War II. In 2 Timothy, Paul lists disobedience to parents as a mark of this age. The modern attitude is all members of the family meet as equals, and each one expresses his ideas and does his own thing. Yes, but there are situations where that won't work. It won't do to have 6 steering wheels and a big automobile. I know you can have 2 for a driver training car, but that's another thing. One person needs to drive the automobile. Some people need to be in authority. The last verse in the book of Judges is, "There was no king in Israel in those days. Every man did that which was right in his own eyes." Everybody did his own thing. And it was a time of confusion and trouble and sorrow. Now, I take it that this commandment requires obedience and respect for all lawful authority, all superiors, beginning with parents. Jesus was subject to Mary and Joseph when they lived at Nazareth. The 2nd chapter of Luke tells us about this. Paul in Romans 13 says we need to be in subjection to the higher powers, the civil magistrates, the police, the tax collectors. Now, they weren't perfect. Nero was probably the emperor when Paul wrote this, and he was anything but perfect. But Hebrews says, Hebrews 13, "Obey them that have the rule over you and submit yourselves." Now, that's talking about the folks that are the officers or the governors, the guides in the church. And we are to obey those that have the rule over us. When the apostles were arrested for preaching in the book of Acts, Acts 5, they said we ought to obey God rather than man. The time comes when the civil government has completely denied what God requires. In that case, we need to put God's command first. And the apostles did, and ended up in jail. Now, if you'd get a book on this, there'd be a chapter on the duties of superiors. Right along with this, it says, "Ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. Bring them up in the nurture and admonition of the Lord." I take it that this commandment means that we ought to teach children that no means no, and that they must obey. I know that there's a big part of modern education that doesn't go with this, but the simple fact is, if the child doesn't learn to obey parents as God's representatives, he won't understand about obedience to the teacher, to the police, to the supervisor at work, and he'll be in trouble. This was something over 40 years ago, and I think it'll be all right to say it this way. I still have so clearly in mind a boy that came into the army, and I was one of the people that helped train him for the first weeks he was in the army. This was a young man who never had learned that no means no, or that you had to do anything that you were told to do. And he thought you could come out in the morning without your leggings on, that you didn't have to have your shoes tied, that you didn't have to have your rifle cleaned. He'd never responded in obedience to anybody. And I still remember getting him one night about 6 o'clock in some buckets, and I stayed with him. I had plenty of time. My wife was a long ways away, and I wasn't in any hurry, and I wasn't angry. But I made him scrub a floor in a big barracks, and I helped him move beds and trunks, and I think we worked on that till 10, 11 o'clock, something like that. And I still remember the change that came over him when he found out that in the Army you had to do what Sergeant told you to do. It was just that simple. Now, far more important than that is that children need to understand that God has ordained authority, and it begins with father and mother. You see, in the Old Testament, in 1 Kings, there's the story of Adonijah, this boy that says, "I'll be king," and tries to drive his father off of the throne. And the writer of the Bible simply says his father had never displeased him by saying, "Why hast thou done so?" His little boy hadn't been disciplined, and it brought trouble. You see, the 9th chapter of Genesis tells us that God ordains government. We had the same thing in Romans 13. The powers that be are ordained of God. Doesn't mean God approves of everything government officials do. Oh, no. But God ordained the idea of government. Now, this commandment prohibits some things. I think it prohibits rebellion against any proper authority. Except, of course, when the authority is against God. When they tell Daniel that he can't pray to anybody but the king for 30 days, Daniel's quietly going to keep on praying to God and end up in the lion's den. The Hebrew children will not bow down to the gods of Babylon, and they're thrown in the furnace. And Peter's going to have trouble in Acts. We talked about that, because he won't do what the authorities tell him when it's the opposite of what God's guiding him to do. Polycarp's going to be put to death, John's disciple. John Bunyan, the famous Baptist preacher in England, going to stay in jail 13 years. They said, "You can't preach." And they finally said to him, "If you'll just promise not to preach, we'll turn you loose." And he has the feeling God has told him to preach, and he stays in prison. And, of course, writes Pilgrim's Progress and some things like that. But here's a man who would not bow down to human government when the government was against God. Now, this would be the time, wouldn't it, to talk about the sins of superiors. Fathers, provoke not your children to wrath. The folks in government have a responsibility to God, and parents have responsibilities. This doesn't mean that we want to set up dictators. Oh, no. And so we have this promise attached to it that thy days may be long. Now, it doesn't mean that every child that learns to obey his parents is going to live be 90 years old. Here's a general principle that long life and prosperity go with learning to respond to authority. I take it then that in summary, this commandment requires a Christian attitude toward government. Paul says to Titus, "Put these folks in mind to be subject to principalities and powers, to obey the magistrates." In 1 Peter, "Submit to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake." The Christian is to be obedient. Jesus said, "Render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's." Not the things that are God's now, but render unto Caesar, the Roman government, the things that belong to it. Paul understands this to mean that a Christian cooperates with authorities in maintaining order. In Acts 27, they were in the storm on the Mediterranean. They got up close to one of the islands, and it was 20 fathoms, a fathom 6 feet approximately, and then 15 fathoms, and then it got more and more shallow. And the sailors on this vessel put out a boat pretending that they were going to drop some anchors. What they were trying to do was slip off in the little boat and just desert the ship. It had been in the storm, and they thought it was going to break up. At that point, Paul, this is in Acts 27, is going to go to the centurion, the Roman official, and say, hey, these sailors are slipping off. We need them to guide this ship to shore. And the soldiers at that point are going to take the ropes that hold the boat and simply cut it off and let it go. But the point is, Paul is cooperating with those in authority. And he's even making a suggestion to them. And, of course, it ended up with the lives of the whole group being spared. Now, the next commandment, the sixth one, very frank and clear, thou shalt not kill. This commandment requires a respect for human life because all men are made in the image of God. Psalm 8 says God has made us a little lower than the angels. This commandment requires the preservation of lives of others and of ourselves. Now, there's going to be a great deal of explanation of this in the Old Testament. Deuteronomy 22 says when you build a house, you put a battlement on the roof. Now, they made the roof flat and put steps on, usually, on the outside, going up to it and used the roof. Something is the way we'd use a patio. And what this says is put a railing, a fence around it, so folks won't fall off. In other words, protect lives. Put railings on dangerous staircases is what this would mean to us. And we ought to keep dangerous animals in fences and drugs out of the way of children. And we ought to learn to drive with good brakes on our cars. This means that we ought to teach children about germs and sanitation. It means that we should care for the sick, that we should get some folks to the doctor, that we should support missionary hospitals. The folks that have worked on this commandment have the expression, there should be a sober use of meat, drink, and physic, sleep, labor, recreation. In other words, we can break this commandment, thou shalt not kill, by eating too much and shortening our lives, by drinking too much of the wrong thing, by too much medicine, too much sleep. We got more folks, I expect, that don't get enough. Too much work, too much recreation. You see, this commandment is, again, in so many different forms. In Genesis 9, as governments are ordained, whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God made he man. Here's why it's so serious to take a human life, except in the case of public justice or maybe lawful war that's a defense or something like this. Jesus is going to interpret this commandment to include motives. He's going to say, whosoever hates his brother is a murderer. Things like this. Hatred is the motive back of so much murder. Cain killed Abel because he was jealous. Joseph's brothers started to kill him in their jealousy and then sold him into Egypt. Saul, the first king of Israel, was jealous of David and ended up destroying himself and his family. Ahab coveted Naboth's vineyard, and Jezebel the queen had Naboth put to death. Manasseh hated Isaiah's preaching and put him in a hollow log and sawed the prophet and the log into to get rid of this kind of preaching. And Jewish writings have the details about this. It's referred to in the 11th chapter of Hebrews when it says they were sawn asunder. But I'm talking about the motive that Manasseh had. Stephen and Paul and Polycarp and thousands of folks in our generation have been put to death because people hated Christ and the gospel. Now, I would think very much this commandment forbids suicide by the inch. I'm talking with this expression, cutting off the cat's tail an inch at a time. There's such a thing as folks killing themselves a little at a time by drink, drugs, neglecting their health, worrying themselves to death, eating wrongfully, and things like this. I would understand very definitely that this commandment forbids abortion as it's now practiced. The latest figure I've seen is in our country, we're murdering about 1.7 million babies a year, though the figure 1.5 million is more common. But killing one baby is wrong. The Bible regards the unborn as real persons. And I've got a whole list of references to that here. The church fathers that we were talking about a while ago, the friends of John and Paul, are just as clear about this as they could be. One of these early books says, do not murder a child by abortion or kill a newborn infant. And Tertullian is so clear about this in his Apology. And Barnabas and Athenagoras. And you say, are those not books in the Bible? No, but they had abortions back in that period. And these men stood against it because they understood that life is sacred because man is made in the image of God. The folks in the early church were so clear about the importance of life, and they based it ultimately on this commandment, thou shalt not kill. And the thing I want us to remember is that this includes motives. This includes attitudes. This includes anything that takes or shortens a human life. And may God's blessing rest upon us as we live our lives.